So I'd like to continue to the discussion of topological D-brains and Landau-Ginzburg models. But since Nigel just finished discussing generalized Keller structures, I wanted to make a remark that we saw that the generalized Keller structures lead to something closely related to supersymmetric backgrounds and supergravity. And it's interesting that they also appear in describing mirror symmetry or they can be used to formulate some results about n equals 2 superconformal field theories associated to tori. So I couldn't refrain from saying that. So that you have two tori. With some flat Keller metric in the corresponding Keller form and complex structure in B field. Another torus like that. Then the most elegant way to formulate the criterion when these two sets of data give the same n equals 2 superconformal field theories actually involve the generalized Keller structures you can make from these data and these data. So there is a two tori lead to isomorphic n equals 2 superconformal structures, n equals 2 superconformal field theories, basically when there is an isomorphisms of double tori, torus for the dual torus. This, which preserves this generalized, both general, well, preserves generalized Keller structure, that it takes this generalized complex structure to this one and that one to that one. So, yeah. So it's kind of amusing. So it shows that many things in string theory can be usefully formulated in terms of notion that Nigel introduced. And actually, the two tori produce mirrors, two superconformal field theories related by mirror symmetry. When there is an isomorphism of tori, when which exchanges the two parts of the generalized Keller structure, that is the generalized complex structure made of this, which exchanges this one, and vice versa. So I have no idea why this happens, just a fact. So perhaps the calculation. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, it seems like it is related. So, Nigel describes related to some infinitesimal version of T duality, and for tori, it's actually the same as exact T duality. So, perhaps the whole argument, the whole derivation of this criterion, can be formulated more neatly in terms of if you introduce this generalized complex structure to begin with somehow in the description of superconformal field theory.
So, the generalized complex structures defined by omega I and IV, these are generalized complex structures on T.
Yeah, on T.
Only on T.
Right, but these are some tensors on T plus T star, right?
Or you just rewrite them as tensors.
Right. And the isomorphism is not for the tori, it's for the doubled one, because it's T duality. So. All right, just an aside. So last time I was discussing some particular example of matrix factorization problem, namely through potential like this, I consider it particularly simple factorization. And in that case, the endomorphism algebra of the corresponding brain is also very simple. It's just two-dimensional, so generated by the identity, and then there is a odd generator satisfying theta squared equal to zero. I mentioned that, well, this algebra doesn't really seem to care about what n is. Well, this is strictly speaking true for n greater than 2. But if one remembers that, well, this was just, this algebra was a cohomology of some differential graded algebra. And as usual, when you go to the cohomology, the differential graded algebra carries some extra structure. Well, the cohomology carries some extra structure, which called the A-infinity structure. So it's actually homotopy associative algebra with zero differential. And actually, these higher products do remember about this N. Okay. And let me just explain what I mean by this. So let me compute one of these higher products in the simplest case, namely, let me set N equals to 3. Okay. Let me just first remember, recall the general definition of this massive products, or more in the terminology of this infinity products, that is the following. So, in general, these massive products are defined only up to homotopy. But what happens is, you know, that if all massive products below the nth one sort of vanish, then the nth one is defined uniquely. So in this case, theta squared is 0, so n equals 2 terminology, so m2 of theta and theta is 0. So we can hope to define m3 of theta, 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 the trilinear product unambiguously. And actually want to show that it's minus 1. Yeah, the endomorphism algebra. Yeah. Okay. So. Well, it just. Well, in this case, we just have DG algebra of endomorphism. Then we pass to its homology, right? To compute. Well, the general procedure was right. So we had this phi, which are matrices with polynomial entries. And it had a differential which maps phi to anti-commutator of phi with this Q boundary, where Q boundary in this particular case, is 2 by. Yeah, phi is a morphism, endomorphism of this brain, actually.
Endomorphism.
So that's why you can multiply them and you can get an algebra. And it's actually differential is Zeno 2-graded algebra because we have this d acting on it, and d squared does vanish because q boundary squared is a central element. In general, there's some procedure to compute, infinity. Well, the cohomology of this has some infinity homotopy associative structure, and the first non-trivial guy is uniquely defined. So it's defined not up to homotopy, just it's really. In the old way to refer to this massive product. So let me just compute this massive product using this old-fashioned formulation, which defines these products directly. So the point is the following: suppose I have some differential graded algebra, more abstractly, just do the computation here, and I want to define product of three cohomology classes. Right. Yeah. So it's related to that. Yeah. Well, it's the same argument, but just different algebra. But the argument had nothing to do with string field theory, really. It just was a pure algebraic
thing. Okay. So what algebra is
actually using? Yeah. That's the fact I'm using. I'm just going to compute the lowest of this product. Yeah. So let me just compute the lowest product because. It is unambiguously defined here for this status. So the point is the following, that suppose we have a situation where we have three cohomology classes such that this product of A and B is zero in cohomology, product of B and C is zero in cohomology. I want to assume that A times C is zero, even though in our case it's going to be the case. So then, if you write it, choose some representatives for this product, then you can write, you know, some equation like that, where del is this differential for this differential graded algebra, whatever it is. And the definition of the massive product is this one. So one can check with some work that, well, so this is a cocycle, and you can check that this cocycle, well, if you change, first of all, if you change alpha by d of something, it's all of course possible, it's only going to change this by d of something. And also, one can also check that if you change the representative A for this cohomology class, that shows also this also changes by cocycle. So this is well defined moduli Cobol. Yeah, so sorry. This is well defined. Right. Well, that's why one needs to choose this sign carefully to show the second thing that can change the choice of this A and B and C, and I'm not going to do a thing. Yeah. Well, yeah, in this situation, when you have this pairwise products vanish, it's an ambiguously defined, yeah. So, yeah, in general, when they don't vanish, you can define something like that, but then it's going to depend on various choices. So, okay. So I mean, the totality of all these products does carry some invariant information. That's why that's why these formulas of infinity algebras were developed, you know, because there's some notion of homotopy equivalence, which sort of parameterizes the gauge invariant information. But in some cases, some individual products actually have a particular meaning. That's the case here. So, so let's compute it in our case. So theta is represented by a matrix. Can be represented by a matrix like this. Well, just some particular choice of representative in this cube, in this D cohomology. And if you, theta squared is, of course, just this. And that's supposed to be zero, and it is zero in cohomology. Namely, it's D acting on this. Okay. So now if you just plug in, so therefore this is our alpha, and also this is our beta, because in our case it's just the same. So and then just you multiply these matrices, and you find that indeed M3 of theta is a class of this matrix, which is the identity element in our, minus the identity element in our algebra. Okay. So there are only these higher products, and one can generalize this to show that, one can argue that there, by homotopy can kill all higher products in this case, and in general it's there. For this particular brain, which is obtained by this factorization, is the n-tuple product of theta that doesn't vanish. Okay. So. Right. So if we put in a situation where, well, I don't think there's a string field theory in this case, but in cases when there is a string field theory, well, if we're dealing with some Landau-Ginzburg model which did have some sort of space. Yeah, I mean, not all ingredients somehow present. There's a DG algebra, the Bursty operator, there is a product, but I don't see any inner product which would allow me, say, to write down a string field theory action on the space of these matrices, for example. So I'm not quite sure. One can write down this Maurer-Cartan equation, which is the equations of motion for string field theory, right? But
that's, I think, what this point was that you need somehow for this entity, because somehow you take the product of two spaces and you need to take the cube inverse.
Right, that's what they're doing here, right? We're inverting this D, right?
Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, perhaps, yeah. If I just work maybe with non-holomorphic, because then it's an old form, I could write down some product. I'm not sure. In more complicated Landau-Ginzburg models, like some Gepner models, right, one expects that there is a string field theory interpretation, and then presumably the computation like the one I'm doing here would compute the space-time superpotential for open string moduli, which correspond to this So this state that we have an operation is operated on string, open string model. Yes?
So what it's worth, if you think in terms of clutch theory, where you have an explicit chain limit that can choose the cohomology inside the Kirchhoff complex, then Menkovov wrote down explicit formulas for the IL products in the differential graded algebra, which were then made much more explicit by Kontegich and Vogelmann. And there's some sort of a tree.
Right. So
that is already maybe a final.
Yeah, so this is this graph.
Some kind.
Yeah. So these are the two contributions here, the two trees. So this is a, right. So these are the two trees which you can associate in this formalism conservation soluble one, right? But yeah, so you can, well, you can write down some effective superpotential whose equations of motion are going to describe the moduli space of these D brains. That's still true here.
Yeah.
So in this case, you can say that even here it's a sort of effective superpotential for open
string.
Yeah, that's cubic part in the superpotential basically. So this just the fact that it's non-zero. It's just signals that you cannot really deform this brain in sort of direction of theta, which is sort of odd element which could potentially be infinitesimal deformation. Even though that M2 vanishes, the theta square is zero, there's sort of higher terms at this infinity Marvel Cartan which prevents deformation. That's not surprising. I already mentioned before that in this, for this particular superpotential, every single brain is rigid. They only finite number of decomposable ones, so there's no way you can expect to deform them. So you're going to know that some obstructions are going to come in at some point, and that shows where they come in. So.
The last thing you said before the discussion started. So you were saying that if you take n, which is arbitrary, you expect all the products of degree n to vanish.
Yeah.
And the nth one to be minus one.
Right.
And the physical significance of that is?
Again, there's your potential which is vanishes until, well, there's some degree n potential, right? So for this theta. Except, yeah. So.
No, we started with the degree n potential.
No, I mean, it's a different potential. It's potential for open string moduli. For open string would be moduli, because actually there's a potential that they're not moduli. Yeah. It's a space-time sort of superpotential. Well, this one, it's funny that actually they look the same, right? Both of degree n, right? Except but the variable is different. Here I have some even variable z, and there I have some odd variable theta, so it's not just coincident, basically. So. So hopefully this technology will enable, when one extends all this stuff to Landau-Ginzburg orbifolds, one can, and relevant for the quintic, for example, one can, let's say, describe moduli spaces of some brains by computing this potential using these massive products.
So this M3 is completely
anti-symmetric.
That's why it's.
No, it's not.
Theta is
anti-symmetric. Yeah, theta is. In general, no. In general, no. No particular. There's no particular reason for it to be.
Yeah, precisely. So in the end, that's why it makes sense to write about, to think about the cubic term and the superpotential.
Yeah.
Even
right.
Though,
yeah.
Even though it's odd.
Right. Well, I don't think in general it's not, doesn't have any particular symmetry thing. In general, you just have the non-commuting variables in your superpotential, which is sort of the open string moduli, so you have all kinds of terms there.
But you still have a cubic term in the system.
Yeah. Right. You have to symmetrize. You have to symmetry. So actually, Karin is an expert here, so he wrote a paper on that, which said that. The superpotential can be just written as a power series in these massive products. Okay, so basically we'll have this open. Well, we look at degree one element in cohomology, which parameters there would be perturbations, would be deformations, and then say there is some topological string field theory, which has some DG algebra associated to it and some inner product. say, this holomorphic Chern-Simons one. Well, it also applies to the A model, I guess. So the general structure is the same. And then you can, just on the cohomology, you can compute this A infinity products, right? And then write a generating function for them. So this moduli. Which live in degree one cohomology of the DG algebra, and then you write some using the product on cohomology. They're just degree one. They're just some basis in degree one cohomology of the DG algebra. So we write our general deformation, I guess a sum of Ti Ui, right? And then we write expansion this, and I guess you put the product with this one. Up to sine, if you don't remember. So no, but I mean, I just chose a basis. So, oh, but okay. Yeah, okay. So, I thought use a basis. Right, so we have, yeah, right. No, better, it's easy to write just like this. So, have the coordinates, and then you want coordinates. You have something like. So can you help me here? So. Sorry? You can help? I don't remember the formula.
Okay, so with the substruct framework of cubic string theory, you have the differential graded algebra, okay, with a so called DPC form. Compatible with the differential in the product, so it's satisfied. Okay, so this is basically the abstract data, if you have a single one. And then, mathematically, what you do is you take the minimal model. Now, to really realize that this thing theory, you need to realize this cohomology as a subspace inside H. So you need a cohomology. Thank you. prime is a complement of the kernel in H, while K is the complement of the images and the thing. Okay, doing that, you can find a propagator. It comes from the image of D, S, into L, which is 1 over D times the projector on the image of D. The projector is defined by the speed. Okay? And then you can write this product. And considering prime diagrams, associated to trees with a cubic vertex and with insertions. So this is one of them. An example, where the propagator is U. Here you use the associated product dot. And here you project on thing. This is a four-point function. So what we are doing in the string here is to define an effective progression. And then you compute the tree part of the other vector. So you see it's a function from H1. It's going to be a function from K because the page fits into C. And because of the cohomological speaking, these are isomorphic to H1 and H2. So what's the vertical time space to the modular space of solutions, but we use the motion for that. So we choose the variation of principle for the tension, we get another component condition. And the virtual time space will be obtained by electric nonlinear term. Okay, so this is what this function defines.
So I guess that's the right formula. So
Colin, so I showed that these amplitudes just define the minimum for the products.
So Colin, so I guess that's the right formula for the superpotential?
Yeah, and the formula is
okay, so this fixes the signs and the ends here. Okay. So I hope therefore that for Landau-Ginzburg models which have something to do with string theory, unlike the one I'm considering here, this computation actually could be useful to compute the space-time superpotential. Although, well, I'm not sure how, is it any better than, I'm not sure it's doable. Or interesting examples because, you see, in the example I considered, I didn't have to choose this gauge that Colin's talking about. I could just invert. I had a special station where all the products were zero in cohomology. I could just invert this del bar without choosing any, well, without worrying too much about the gauge. If A times B wasn't zero, I have to first separate the part which is non-zero and then invert del bar, and then I get into a problem. Well, I need to choose a nice gauge. I'm not sure how to choose this gauge in general. Well, so the computation actually doable. So anyway, let me get back to discussing more general models, and So one thing which is sort of glossed over is the following, that when I consider the matrix factorization problem, had this constant there. And the example that just take the trace. It had to be the same constant, but I didn't say what it's supposed to be, right? And in the example that I considered, I choose W not to be the critical value of W. And why did I do that? Well, the reason is that if it's not a you can do it, you can choose arbitrary value if you like, but then this is going to lead to a trivial brain in the sense that then the morphism algebra is just zero identically. And if you wish, you can say that it's a spontaneous breaking of Bariston symmetry, that is, there are just no states in the Bariston cohomology. And that was first noticed by Cantara, and the argument is actually very, there's a physical reason for this. Namely, first of all, we can choose different values of the constant here, okay? So, and D-brain, there are no morphisms between brains which corresponds to different constants. Okay? The reason is that the, roughly speaking, what happens is the following, that, remember, the potential energy is proportional to the gradient of W. So when I have a string which stretches between sort of two different values of W, okay, there's an energy there, okay, and it won't be supersymmetric. So first of all, there can be just no supersymmetric string states which begin at brain at one value of W naught and end on the other value of W naught. So first of all, categories of brains for different values of constant are completely independent. Second, if you have a brain sort of passes through some, well, the brain roughly sits at the kernel of this map F or G. So that's where W is equal to W naught. So if W naught is not the critical value, then there's a potential energy for the string given by derivative of W squared at this point, right? So again, there are no open string states of connecting even brain with itself, not only with other brains, just because it doesn't sit at the minimum of the classical potential. Okay? So if W is not the critical value, you don't expect to see any non-trivial cohomology whatsoever. So therefore, this category of brains will decompose in sort of direct sums of categories, one for each critical value of W. Okay? So not moreover, you expect, since you know in B model everything localizes to constant maps, one expects that actually only the behavior of W near this critical the critical point matters, okay? That is, you don't really, although this factorization, of course, depends on the whole behavior of W, you expect that you can compute in principle everything you need to know about branches but from the behavior of W near the critical point. And this has been given very precise meaning by a theorem of Orlov, which I'm going to formulate now, which is, well, first of all, it makes precise this what I said about the about the only the neighborhood of the singularity, well, neighborhood of the critical points of W matters. And second, it actually is a useful tool for classifying brain in some cases.
Why did you say that? There were two statements that brains corresponding to two different values of W do not interact.
Yeah.
There was another statement that you only get brains when W not is a critical value.
You get non-trivial brains. That is, the endomorphism algebra of a brain is non-vanishing. Okay. Just because the potential energy for a string, which sort of, so this is some W equals W naught. If W naught is not the critical value, there's some potential energy. Okay, then string carries non-zero energy. So in special cases, this is actually explained by Cantaro in some paper, I think, on linear models for D-brain conditions. Okay. Sorry. So Orlov gave a precise theorem which makes this, makes this precise, first of all. So he, namely, he considered the following. So suppose you have this function W, and consider the equation W equal to W naught, okay? So, or well, roughly speaking, it's some variety, but you better can just consider, you know, the, say, C of X. The algebra of function modulo this equation, and this is some, in general, some scheme, the nilpotent elements in this algebra. And that's roughly speaking the algebra of functions on the on this variety or scheme. Okay. So Orlov first of all introduced some interesting category related to this scheme. He said, we can take the look at the derived category of modules, or the derived category of coherent sheaves on this affine scheme, and then we can do the following thing. We can look at some interesting subcategory in it, namely the one made of complexes, each term of, so such that each term in it is a, so we take the derived category of this scheme, which I'll call, say, A, x prime W naught. Okay. And if there's a subcategory made of complexes which are made of locally free sheaves, or some complex which is quasi-isomorphic to that. So these are called perfect complexes. And we can take the subcategory of this derived category by perfect complexes. Okay. Actually, if this x W naught was actually a smooth variety, that will give you nothing, zero, because every basically, because every coherent sheaf has a bounded resolution by locally free ones. Okay. But on a singular variety or scheme, you get something non-trivial. Okay. And so he called this category a singularity. Okay. And so one can associate, well, yeah. So that is, you declare morphisms to be zero if they factor through objects in this subcategory. That's roughly what quotienting means. So sort of you want to declare all these objects to be zero, okay? And therefore declare all morphisms which. So this object here just consists of complexes which are made of locally free sheaves, okay? So huge vector bundles in some sense, okay? And usually, if you work on a smooth variety, that's all you need in any case, right? But for singular guys, that's not true, because if you try to resolve some, in general, some object by locally free sheaves, you get an unbounded resolution. Okay? And that's why it's interesting to quotient by this guy. Suppose we get something much smaller, okay? Something which only cares about the singularity of this x. So this category only cares about stuff which leaves it sort of singularity of X. Okay, so that's what I call category of singularity. And of course, if W naught is not at a critical level, not a critical value of W, then you're just going to get zero because you get a smooth, affine variety. Well, and Orlov showed that actually this category of B brains obtained by this matrix factorization for some particular value of W naught is precisely is equivalent to this category of singularity for the same value of W naught. So that sort of immediately tells you that for if W naught is not the critical value of W, then so the category of B brains is trivial, as I said, and also makes precise a statement that actually this category really only depends on the behavior near the critical, near the singularity, near the critical point of W. Okay. Yeah. So, I'm not sure in general whether this is easier to compute than this category of pairs, okay? But in special cases, it is like.
But at least it gives you a definition in general.
Sorry?
You derive this category of pairs as the right object when your x was affine.
Yeah, everything is affine here, so.
Right, but what if it's not? In many cases, it's not.
Yeah, in general, I don't know. Okay.
This will give you a definition, though. I don't know whether.
That gives a definition. So I guess the theorem maybe makes sense to that case. So no, there's a definition also. Well, I can define this category of pairs in general, just more complicated definition. I'm not sure whether it's still the same as category of singularity. It is possible to do it. So this some general theorem, but sometimes it's actually useful. The point is that if you want to study, if you want to consider the simplest potential, sort of hard to tell how many ways to factorize the reason. Mainly because you know that many of these ways of factorizing looks different, but then they become equivalent once you go to this homotopy category. And this actually can be hard to tell whether they found all the brains. So I wrote down these solutions. And I actually claim that these are this is all there is. All the rest are sort of direct sums of this. And this theorem helps in this particular case to show that's the case, because see that this critical level set has dimension one lower than X itself. So like here, X was one dimensional. So this X W naught is actually zero dimensional. So it's easy to classify, to figure out what this thing is for a zero dimensional scheme, right? So this algebra just becomes C of X mod X to the N, okay, in this particular case. And modules over this are just, sort of basically all interesting modules are these ones. And this is just basically Jordan normal form theorem. So these are all the interesting modules. And then when Orlov says quotient by these perfect complexes, this case basically, well, it turns out it just means the quotient by the I corresponding to N, because in that case it's just a free guy, so just quotient by that. So just left with these modules with I strictly less than N, okay? And these are all the indecomposable objects there are, okay? And one can show actually that they correspond to these factorizations, where K runs from 1 to N minus 1. So for more complicated through potential, well, so could be also, well, could be interesting to see whether it helps us to classify brains in some more complicated models. So, actually, well, for example, it's known due to this work on singularity theory that if you consider, say, D and E type minimal models, say this is a D type model, then the number of indecomposable brains is still finite, but I don't know how to construct all of them. So I don't know how many there are. That's a D type minimal model. But at least I can construct some brains here. I actually think that these are all there are. And actually, in general, how do you construct examples of factorization for more complicated super potentials? So more complicated than just one monomial. So what is a general trick? Suppose you have a potential which is made of two pieces. And they may depend on the same variables. It doesn't matter. So suppose you already found some factorization of W1. So I prefer, actually, let me write this. It's convenient to use this degree one differential D, or I call it Q boundary before. Simpler object. Simpler to write the equation. Suppose you already know how to factorize W1. And you'll know how to factorize W2. Okay. And then I can construct factorization for W just by, so D1x in some vector space and then D2 also. So we just, first, naive idea, just take the tensor product of these two vector spaces and two differentials. So you can try it this way. Well, that doesn't quite work because, because we get anti-commutative of D1 and D2. Well, in fact, they commute because they're in separate tensor products. So we need some sort of graded tensor product, which means that let's introduce so what we really want is to put some anti-commuting factors here. Okay. Which live in a separate vector space, which satisfy the Clifford algebra relations. So then it will work. D squared will be W. So if you have, say, n pieces in the superpotential, you know how to factorize each piece. So you just can take this graded tensor product by introducing some representation of the Clifford algebra with n generators and forming this sum. Okay. So it gives lots of examples of factorizations for more complicated superpotentials like this one, for example. And I suspect that for D-type minimal model, these are all factorizations. Well, all the brains are just obtained by this construction from factorizing separately these two monomials, but I'm not sure. Well, I mean, just enlarge make a brain of bigger rank, right? So in this case, for example, we can just take two-dimensional representation of this Clifford algebra. So just take bigger rank brain, and then we make sure that you want this D1 roughly, and D2 sort of anti-commute instead of commute, because they're odd. And that's just a way to ensure that. So, let's see. So next topic I would like to address is now we know the structure of the open string state stretched between the various B brains, and we know how to multiply them, so we know the boundary OPE algebra. And next we would like to compute some correlators. And in other words, so what we have, the structure we have so far, this topological field theory with boundary is the following. We know how to, you know, the algebra structure on this vector space is HMN. Well, if your category structure on this vector space is HMN. Okay. In particular, we know the algebra structure on endomorphism of any brain. And the only other piece of information, so we need another piece of information we need is the trace on endomorphisms. Okay. So using this two pieces of data, we can compute arbitrary, say, disk correlators with only boundary insertions. And more generally, I like to compute correlators with both boundary insertions and bulk insertions. And that requires another piece of data. Bulk boundary map. Well, it's a boundary bulk map. It's easier not to compute this guy separately, just to evaluate this correlator. So, and then we can go backwards and extract this data. And before I do this, let me remind how this can be done for closed string, for a logarithmic model without boundaries. It has been done by Waffa, and the general trick is the following. First of all, one argues using supersymmetry, using Bernstein invariance, that the path integral localized on constant fields, that is constant maps and just constant modes of the fermions, and then one gets some ordinary integral. And then to evaluate this ordinary integral, Waffa does some additional simplification. He assumes that the superpotential only has non-degenerate critical points. And then one can argue again that, the saddle point approximation is exact because of this Bernstein invariance, and then just can evaluate these Gaussian integrals around every critical point and get some answer for arbitrary correlator on a sphere, for example, or actually on higher genus Riemann surface. Of course, one can ask what happens when the superpotential has degenerate critical points. Well, the argument is that everything should depend holomorphically on the coefficients of the superpotential. So if once you know it for generic situation, you can recover it for any special situation just by analytic continuation. So So let me just write down the formulas that are obtained in this way. So Wafa is sufficient to compute a one-point function on a sphere. Okay. So that's a disk. A sphere. So for the sphere case, well, it corresponds to this map from H to C. So a one-point function on a sphere, which is the same as a trace map on our algebra of closed strings, is the following. It's given by some residue, where F belongs to this Jacobi ring. And these are just partial derivatives of superpotential. So the integral, so the thing which stands here, therefore, is some meromorphic function of n variables. So it doesn't mean to take a residue. Well, for one variable, it's fairly clear. For n variables, one should just take the integral of this meromorphic function. Well, first of all, it needs to make it into a meromorphic n form by multiplying by dz1, which dzn, oh, sorry, dx1, which dxn. And then one gets this meromorphic n form. Then one integrates it over an n, Lagrangian n cycle given by the equation like this, where epsilon i's are small. Okay. Which is Lagrangian cycle sort of encircle the critical points of W. So that's this multidimensional residue. Well, this residue has some properties which I'm not going to show. Now, like, for example, why is this thing well defined? For example, if I shift F by something proportional to some derivative of W, why doesn't this change? Well, that, well, basically the derivative cancels one of this and becomes not singular enough to get non-zero results. So this is actually a well-defined formula, which gives a trace on the Jacobi ring. Another question is, why does it give a, well, this trace is not completely arbitrary. Namely, it's supposed to give a metric which is non-degenerate. Namely, trace of F times G should give a non-degenerate metric on the Jacobi ring. Okay. The topological metric. Well, the fact is non-degenerate is non-trivial. So it's nevertheless true, and we sort of knew it beforehand because Wafa derived it from a path integral, and path integral is supposed to satisfy this axiom, well, this axiom is a topological field theory, but it's still good to check afterwards. Now we can apply the same strategy to open string case. So there we're interested in the disk correlator, and it, well, with arbitrary number in principle of boundary and bulk insertions, but actually it's without loss of generality, one may restrict to the case when there's only one boundary insertion and one bulk insertion. So the method of evaluating the integral is the same. We just first argue that you can restrict to zero modes, that is to constant modes. We get an ordinary integral with some weight which is more complicated than Wafa's because we have this contribution coming from the boundary, this super trace of some exponential matrix. But one can further simplify this by assuming, again, as Wafa did, that superpotential is non-degenerate. Because then, as I explained before, near each critical point, this F, near each non-degenerate critical point, this F and, well, this D behaves like this, where the I is the local coordinates around some this non-degenerate critical points, and gamma I satisfy the relation of the Clifford algebra to some non-degenerate form, which is the Hessian of W. So everything reduces to Clifford algebras. So we can do this, one can do this integral rather simply. So let me just state the final answer for this correlator. So we insert some element of the Jacobi ring here, which is represented by some polynomial f, and some endomorphism of the brain here, must be endomorphism because it's the same brain all over, okay, around the boundary of the disk. So this is the formula then. So this formula was derived in with my student Yi Li, so let me explain the meaning of these terms here. So first of all, n is the dimension of our affine space, and this is the exterior derivative of D. So remember, D is a matrix-valued function. Actually, D just looks like this. And its exterior, so I take its exterior derivative, it's some one form, holomorphic one form, matrix holomorphic one form, then take its nth exterior power, it's a holomorphic n form, matrix holomorphic n form on affine space, so it's proportional to this expression, it's proportional to dv1, dx1, which dxn. Okay. And I prefer to strip it off. So if I get just a function here, not a form. Okay. So this is a matrix. So this piece is just still a matrix valued homomorphic function. And then phi is also a matrix valued homomorphic function. Just multiply them and take super trace. Okay. So then I get an ordinary polynomial, which you multiply by another polynomial with f, and then take the residues before. So since this formula was obtained by some non-rigorous manipulation with the path integral, so it's good to check that it does satisfy some properties expected from a disk correlator. Yeah, so you just put lots of these phis here and lots of f's here. Yeah, so one thing is, by the way, that it doesn't matter how you distribute these phis inside these individual factors of del D. I can, if you can show that. So it's actually some of the checks one can make that the formula is okay. So there is the path ordering doesn't matter somehow. Right. Yeah. So first multiply them and then apply this formula. Right? That's why I say it's sufficient to consider this case. Actually, one can also consider correlators on higher genus Riemann surface. One can write down explicit formula for that. So maybe I'll do it later. Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, so I prefer to go backwards because from this, of course, I can derive this bulk boundary map, which I wrote before. Okay. So now, one obvious check on this rule. First of all, why is it well defined? It's already not so obvious because phi should be representative of this decohomology. So what happens if I say phi is d alpha? Well, really, it should be the super commutator with alpha, where alpha is some other matrix polynomial. Why does it vanish? Well, the point is that the following, that d squared is w. Okay. And therefore, we have the following identity. Right. So you see that although derivative of d doesn't anti-commute with d, it intercommutes up to this gradient of W. And that gives zero result anyway because of the properties of the residue. So you can, so when you have something like this, you can take one of these D, so it's D alpha plus minus alpha D. You can take this D, sort of pull it through, use cyclic property of the super trace, and then I'm going to hit on the other side, okay, until it gets zero. Okay. So, so, well, one just needs to keep track of the sign. So, easy exercise. So this formula is well defined. Another simple check is that if I say, well, consider something like that, two-point correlator, it's supposed to obey graded cyclic symmetry. So if I put phi 1 on the other side, it's supposed to just change, maybe change sign, that's it. Okay. And that's, again, not so obvious. It only holds because phi 1 and phi 2 are declosed. Because you see, it's supposed to be the same as... this only holds because phi 1 and phi 2 are declosed. Because the fact that we have this, implies this. And then we see that the derivative of d anti-commutes with phi 1 up to d exact terms. Okay. So I already proved that putting in some d exact terms here doesn't change anything. So therefore, we might as well treat phi 1 as anti-commuting with the derivative of d, and then just pull it through and then use again cyclic property of the super trace. So, okay. So this is the trivial check on this. Okay. It all makes sense. So since you can glue arbitrary, well, let me just write down then this bulk boundary bulk maps. I can just read off from this formula. So I'm going to write down formula for this guy. Map from endomorphism algebra of some brain to closed string space. So this is just, well, just reading it off, you can see that so phi endomorphism is mapped to the following thing. Okay. It's some sort of generalized Chern character, something like that, looks like that. Okay. Because you can think of this thing here, d. Del D as a curvature of some superconnection. Okay. So, yeah, so it's actually a well-defined element of the Jacobi ring. That is, if you change phi by co-boundary, then this guy shifts by something proportional to gradient of W. Basically, I already showed that. Okay. So, so these are all the data one needs to specify topological field theory with boundaries. And... right, the special case is the boundary state. Well, in general, it may even vanish. If I don't, there may be some zero modes on the disk which make this thing vanish. For example, no, it doesn't always vanish. So, on, for example, for dimension 1, for n equals to 1. Yeah. So, given any d, any factorization, I get some boundary state. Yeah, this part I don't understand. Yeah, I don't understand the case. Yeah. I don't understand the integral structure which you obtain. And yeah, so this gives some lattice or what? Yeah, this part I don't understand yet. It will be interesting to understand. Let me just state some things. Well, these are sort of obvious checks that I made, but there are all these consistency conditions for all this data. And this I don't know how to check, actually. Let me state it. That seems rather non-trivial. So the first non-trivial fact, which should hold, but I don't know whether it does, is a non-degeneracy of this open string metric. Okay. So this formula said that this open string metric is given by this residue formula. Corresponds to this diagram, and it's supposed to be non-degenerate. Okay. Now I checked in some examples that it is non-degenerate on cohomology. Okay, not everywhere of decohomology, but I don't know why. In general, why it is non-degenerate in general. That's actually an interesting math problem. Sorry? Yeah, so we just open string metric for endomorphism algebra. Yeah, so in general, there's some also pairing of HMN and HNM, which is non-degenerate. Okay. So all this non-degeneracy facts should hold. Well, the analogs in this case of the serre duality in the Calabi-Yau case. Okay. So that was pretty non-trivial to prove it. Okay. So serre duality is non-trivial. So this also maybe less non-trivial fact, but still non-trivial fact. So that's some Landau-Ginzburg analog of serre duality. Okay. So So let me state another interesting, well.
Is this supposed to hold for arbitrary singularities of the superpotential or only for isolated ones?
Well, I assume that they're all isolated. Yeah, so I assume they're all isolated. Now, well, this story should, well, I think in this affine case, they have to be isolated for anything to make sense. Okay. So in general, well, more general spaces may only require that maybe the critical set is compact or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's okay.
But then it could be some form of relative duality.
Yeah,
so there are forms of relative duality. For
so maybe you can tell me later whether there is which actually factor is known. Okay. So another interesting non-trivial consistent check is the Cardy condition. And the Cardy condition, as I said, it computes, it tells you that the supertrace of some endomorphism. So, you know, so this space is a left module over HMM and right module over HNN. Okay. And so given some element from here there, I have some linear map from HMN to itself. And the Cardy says that the Cardy condition says that the supertrace of this map can be computed in terms of open-closed maps from HMM and HNN to H. So let me just write down explicitly what this means in the special case when alpha and beta are just one, sort of the analog of the growth of the Hirzebruch-Riemann-Roch theorem for this situation. It says that early characteristic of HMN can be computed by taking some residue interesting exercise to check whether that's really the case.
This is just a diagram.
Right, yeah. Well, there's a double twist diagram. Well, double twist diagram with triple insertions. The usual Cardy thing. Sorry?
Do you know this is true or
not? No, I don't know. That's what Cardy says. I checked in some examples when, but right. But I don't know how to check it in general. In many cases, it just vanishes because this thing vanishes. But I don't know how to check in general. So, well, no. For minimal model, well, for if you add squares to the superpotential, you get also this orientable brains, and then often this thing is non-zero. Okay. Even if you consider like z to the n plus y squared, there are some brains with non-trivial. Oh yeah, sure, yeah. So you can check this in special case. I don't know why it holds in general. So the fact it was derived from the path integral suggests that, you know, Cardy condition holds, but it's all non-rigorous, so somebody should better check this. Okay. geometry in general. Close to open? Yeah, right. Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, I don't understand well this map from, well, this one, the adjoint of this to say anything about this either. Okay. So I guess I want to talk about before the Landau-Ginzburg models, but I don't think we have time today. So, well, orbifolds are interesting because they have more relevance to physical quantifications, to Gapner models. Instead, I'm going to talk about how to recover. Well, I would like to show that closed strings are some Hochschild cohomology of the category of brains. Okay. And in this case, it's much easier to make it concrete than in the case of Kolobyov's. So, the notion of a Hochschild cohomology of a category is somewhat nebulous for me. So, first, I'd like to express this in terms of more reasonable terms as Hochschild cohomology of some algebra, or some version of algebra. So, so we have these pairs. And in what sense are they modules or anything? So, the condition, if you take on this condition. Well, it turns out that there's a very useful notion called CDG algebra, curved differential graded algebra, which is a special case of an infinity algebra. So, I don't like to think about infinity algebras in general, but this CDG algebras are very useful in many cases. And like actually, they're also useful when there is a B field of type 0,2 that's relevant to this special case of generalized complex structure that Nigel was discussing. So, I'm going to discuss in the main context of the superpotential. So, the point is the following: that let's recall first what's the usual differential graded algebra is. We'll have some algebra, some derivation of the algebra, meaning that the Leibniz rule is satisfied, or super Leibniz. And then we want also d squared to be 0. Okay. And a module over differential graded algebra is a module over the algebra A, or graded module, and some linear map from M to itself, such that the Leibniz rule is satisfied. We shouldn't have called this M's. And then we want also dm squared to be 0. That's called a module over differential graded algebra. And of course, the classical example is we can take, for example, the Deram, A to be the algebra of forms on some smooth manifold, and D to be the Deram differential, and then a differential graded, example of a differential graded module over differential graded algebra of this type is a vector bundle with a flat connection. Okay. So, so we need to generalize this for our purposes. CDG algebra. So what is this thing? Well, C stands for curved. So you can guess what's going on here. So we have still A, D, satisfying the Leibniz rule. But now there's also some degree 2 element in the Z-graded case, or even element in the Z-mod 2 graded case, such that D squared is commutator with B. Okay. So, suppose, for example, you have, say, some vector bundle on the manifold with a connection, then the endomorphism bundle of this vector bundle is a CDG algebra where B is the curvature. Okay. That's why it's called curved differential graded. So the notion of CDG module . Well, we have a module over A. We have a derivation. The same way as before, there is a super Leibniz rule, except that now dm squared is not zero, it's b times. Okay. Well, I just want to say that trivial observation that while DG algebra can be thought of as a module over itself, a CDG algebra is not a module over itself because there's a commutator here and there's multiplication there. Okay. So now I can reformulate this then in terms of the CDG algebra very simply. So let's take our CDG algebra with the algebra of polynomials. It's going to be purely even. In the Z-mod 2 graded case, take the differential to be 0 and take the special element to be W. Now, this sounds a bit funny because, this of course is satisfied because B in my case is a central element, right? So D is 0, but commutator with B vanishes. Now, the notion of module though over this guy is not the same as the notion of module just over A, okay? Because we have some module over this CDG module, then dm squared to satisfy this, right? It's precisely what I want. So therefore, we can think of these pairs as CDG modules over CDG algebra, which I described, a very simple one, purely even, and this procedure of going to the homotopy category can be thought of as going to the derived category of CDG modules over the CDG algebra. I will not make this precise. Okay. Once this is understood, one can figure out what is the sort of a reasonable definition of Hochschild cohomologies in this case. That is, Hochschild cohomology should be just Hochschild cohomology of the CDG algebra instead of this category, whatever that may be. So, one approach to defining it then is just take the Hochschild complex, somehow deform it using the fact that we don't want D squared to be zero, we want D squared to be something else. Okay. So to understand better what's going on, it's better take a geometric viewpoint to say, before we sort of thought as, well, for ordinary algebras, we want to think of A as a module over A tensor A opposite. And then Hochschild cohomology is just given by these X groups in the category of modules over this algebra, A to A. So one can think of this as sort of diagonal in the spectrum of this guy. Okay. So as I said, A is no longer a CDG module now citation over itself, right? So what do we do? Well, it's not CDG module over itself, but it is CDG module over this. Okay. And what is this? Well, so what is A opposite? Our A is commutative, and opposite in this case just means reverse the sign of W for this element. So, and then it's easy to see that D squared A equals W A minus A W, which is actually zero, is the condition that it's a module over this algebra A tensor A with a zero differential and special element W tensor 1 minus minus 1 tensor W. Okay. So, and then I can still think of this A sort of diagonal in the tensor product of A and A opposite. Okay. So, then we want to compute the endomorphism of this brain in the product space, if you wish, to get the Hochschild cohomology. That's supposed to be the procedure. And we hope that it's going to be, again, the closed string algebra as before. Okay. Actually, I'd like to show that not only the algebra structure, but also the trace can be extracted from this. That is, the open string trace for this object sitting on the product is actually the closed string trace that Waffle derived. So you can recover everything you need to know about closed string just by looking at open strings. Okay. So I'll do the trace next time, but let me just outline how to derive actually the you get the Jacobi ring from this. Okay. So this was one kind of principle. Well, one has to write a resolution of this module by three modules here, okay, in order to apply our procedure. Well, there's a Hochschild resolution, which is huge, so I'm not going to do that, although it's also possible. But so Lev Rozanski suggested that we can just deform a Kochel resolution of the diagonal in this affine situation. Okay, so, namely, let me work in the case of when n is 1, because I want to keep things simple. So we want to factorize this zero potential of two variables. Okay. And one can do it by one by one matrices again in the one variable case. One just writes D to be x minus y. And here we have this. So obviously what we want to satisfy, right? And then if you compute the D cohomology, so what do you get? Well, what one gets is that, first of all, there's no odd part to the cohomology. Okay, so there's an even part. Dimensional or affine space, just line. It's going to be line here. Well, it's because I have product of two copies, right? So n is 1 in the sense that A was C of X. And this is the C of xy is the A times the opposite. Okay. So we just compute the cohomology of this D. It's a trivial exercise. There's no odd elements in the cohomology. And the even ones can be represented by this matrices. And the quotient by the image of D just means that A is identified with A plus anything times X minus Y plus anything times WX minus WY divided by X minus Y. Okay. So here I use the fact that actually these two polynomials are relatively prime. Okay. Now of course quotienting just by this just means you can set X equal to Y of two variables to start with, but the quotient by x equals to y, right? You can just set x equal to y here, and then this becomes derivative, right? So we do get the Jacobi ring. We get a space of polynomials of one variable modulo derivatives. So now if you plug in this D, okay, in the formula for this open string, well, in this case, n equals to 2, so it's square. Dy. just not hard to convince yourself that you get just Waffle's formula. Okay. So one gets so phi is just this guy. Okay, so one gets A of XX like this. It needs to do some integrals. Okay. So we integrate once if you wish over Y and then just get the integral over X. So the whole closed string stuff structure can be derived from open strings just by computing Hochschild cohomology and the natural structures in it. Now, this illustration of what I said should be true also for D-brains and Calabi-Yau manifolds. It's also up here.